Well, the nickel cake pair you undoubtedly also have, but I'm gambling in each case and hope that we don't have too many duplications. The speaker here is Einar Hansen, talking at Modesto, California, November 3, 1957. The original recording was made by Bill Mitchell of Modesto, who sent it to me. This talk is a very, very excellent educational type of talk, and we think that you will enjoy it, and that particularly some of your people who still are wondering why, and the background of being an alcoholic, it could give some explanations that might help. If you have the talk, let me know. Bonnie and I both enjoy NRA. We play this tape every once in a while for newcomers, or beginners, whatever you want to call them. Einar has passed away, he's no longer with us, but his tapes still linger on and do a good job.
Of Modesto. The first voice you will hear is Ken B. of Stockton, who in turn will introduce the speaker, Einar Hansen.
When I came in tonight, Art said, what's the lowdown on Einar? That's a big thing to have to hand a fella on short notice. And I said, well, to simplify things, I'll introduce him for you if you'd like. And he said, well, that's well. So that gives me a chance to get in a few licks. Einar's been coming down to the Stockton State Hospital. He lives in Sacramento. He's been coming down about every 3 or 4 months for the past 2 years. Every time he's got a turnover in personnel, he's always willing to come. And he seems to get through to those patients better than any other speaker I've ever been able to get. So when the 2 months are up, I'm always very glad to ask him to come again. I'm getting almost ashamed of myself to keep doing it, but I still do it. You know, he's a very remarkable fellow, and I have to be very careful in what I say about him, because I have to watch out for his ego. If I get it a little too strong, he gets a little too egotistical and cocky, and then we have to, after the meeting, we have to take him out and knock his ears down. But for a fellow that's totally blind, he has a remarkable bunch of attainments. We had him out bass fishing not long ago, and he caught his fish right along with the rest of us. I've heard rumors, now he has never admitted this to me, but I've heard rumors that he holds a master's degree in psychology. Is that right, Ida?
Not officially.
Well,
graduate work in training.
At any rate, he has quite a bit more education than I have, and probably a general average of human beings that getting his AA meeting. And he's done a lot of research on this matter of alcoholism. So what he has to say is a lot different from the average AA pitch. It's remarkable to know a fellow like him that has his handicap, and yet he spends all his time helping other people that are blind, as well as those of us that have a drinking problem. He reads Braille, and he said that has certain advantages too. He says you can read in bed with your book under the covers on a cold night and not get your arms cold. So you see, and I could go on and on and on like that, but I would just be taking up his time, and let's get him started, because he's really got a story. I am sorry.
He forgot to say that I read counts like a book, too. Braille book. My dream. Well, what I'm going to tell you tonight may seem different from the ordinary AA talk, I would like you to think of it as coming in the same way as an AA talk. you all know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are no big shots, and nobody professes to be an authority. Even Bill Wilson, the 100 people who began AA, would be the last to say that they know all the answers. None of us knows all the causes and the cures of alcoholism. AA is not founded on authority. It's founded on case histories. If you look at the big book, you'll see the last half of the big book is made up of case histories. Essentially what we do in AA, we say, this is what I was like, this is what I did, it worked for me. If any part of this is helpful to you, you're most welcome to it. On the other hand, if anything that was helpful to me or anything I might say doesn't strike you right, you're just as welcome to put it to one side, ignore it, pay no attention to it, and take what is useful to you. Now, what I'm going to say is essentially the same thing, but I'm not going to dwell on what I was like during my drinking days. You'll be able to see as I go along that I was a thorough alcoholic. I had become powerless over alcohol, and I certainly got my life unmanageable. What I'm like now is no different from what any of the rest of you are like when you're staying sober. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous about 12 years ago. I had been sober for some 4 or 5 months when an older brother of mine picked me up at the office, drove me home, and as I was about to get out of the car, he stopped me. He says, "Wait a minute, Ina. I got something to ask you. Why is it that during 10 years of your drinking, when we, your family, tried to get you to quit drinking, you wouldn't quit for us? Neighbors, members of the family, members of the church tried to get you to quit drinking, and you wouldn't quit for us. Now a bunch of stumble-bump drunks come to town. They call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. They say, come on, Ina, get sober, and you get sober for them. Now I know very well they haven't told you a single thing that we hadn't already told you. I said, wait a minute, big brother, you're wrong there. They told me I had a disease, a disease called alcoholism. He says, what do you mean by a disease? What kind of a disease is it? What's the nature of this disease? I quoted our pamphlet to him. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. He says, allergy and be damned. I got an allergy too. Every time I drink a glass of beer, my nose starts to run. The trouble with you is you haven't got any guts, you haven't got any willpower, any backbone. If you had any self-respect and a sense of values and some of the other things, you could drink like I do. But not you. You got to be the pig. You got to drink everything in sight. You got to hide drinks. You got to steal drinks. You got to go out begging and borrowing to get more to drink. Needless to say, that made me furiously angry. I wanted to throw back into his teeth the answers to those questions. Now there are a number of us, not all. There are many of us in AA who feel perfectly satisfied. We're not troubled by questions. But there are some of us who are troubled by questions. Questions as to why, how come, what's the nature of this disease. I know that for a long time after I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we talked about a disease called alcoholism, I thought we were just talking in figures of speech or in parallels to illustrate a point. I never could understand the nature of the disease, and I wanted so desperately to understand. I wanted to have some accurate answers, something that would hold weight to throw back at my brother. Now, my brother isn't the only one. I think a lot of us have a big brother in our own conscience. I'm going to lay out for you some scientific information to illustrate a point. The point is, this disease, alcoholism, is a real, genuine disease. It isn't just a figure of speech. I'll try to point out why that is important later on. I spent some 6 or 8 years, my first years of sobriety in AA. Now, AA kept me sober. I was sober through AA, but I wasn't happy. I was still struggling for answers to a lot of these questions, answers to give the moralist as to why I was different from him and yet not inferior. Okay? I did a lot of studying, and I went through a lot of therapy and things to come up with some answers. Now, I'm going to lay out this information for you, and then try to tie it into the AA program. First of all, I learned that we had been lied to. I had been told alcohol was a stimulant, that it was a habit-forming drug, that it was a tool of the devil, and a lot of other things that it isn't. Alcohol is an anesthetic, plain and simple. If you take, break it down chemically, you'll find the basic ingredient of alcohol is ethyl, E-T-H-Y-L. Now, ethyl is also the basic ingredient of ether, formaldehyde, ethylene, chloroform, and about a dozen other general anesthetics. Now, any sensations you experience when you take a drink of alcohol are brought about by the deadening or the anesthetic effect of alcohol. And like any other anesthetic, no matter how you take it into your system, once it gets into your bloodstream, it begins to deaden your brain, beginning with the highest levels and working downward. Now, in order to understand how that can have any effect on your sensations, how you feel and what you do, it's best to refresh our memory on something that you all know. Your brain, or central nervous system, controls every action, every function, every process of your body. Every reaction, every sensation you experience is controlled and made possible by your brain. Now, your brain has three general divisions. The lowest division is the center down here at the base of the skull, and it controls, for the most part, the basic processes necessary to life, such things as your breathing, your heartbeat, the digestion of your food, the circulation of your blood, and many other things necessary to life but which do not require your conscious attention. The middle division of the brain chiefly is concerned with and makes possible muscle coordination. When you're walking, driving your car, washing the dishes, sawing a board, any activities that are chiefly muscle coordination are made possible and carried on by the middle divisions of the brain. Now, the highest divisions of the brain have two lobes up here in the front part of the skull. They make possible more complicated mental processes such as imagining, thinking, reasoning, making decisions, restraining yourself from doing something, or making yourself do something you don't feel inclined to do. Now, man is not the only animal that has a brain. All animals that have vertebrae also have brains. But the big difference is that man possesses certain higher layers. You see, within these divisions, it's permissible to think of layers of the brain. Now, the higher the layers, the more complex the functions it makes possible. Now, in terms of our problem, of problem drinking or getting into trouble when you do any drinking, one of the most important things that man is capable of performing that no other animal can perform is the function of turning inward and looking at ourselves and comparing ourselves to other people. As Bobby Burns said, "Oh, would some power the gift had given us to see ourselves as others see us." Now, we can't see ourselves as others see us, but we can't help and we can't keep from seeing ourselves as we think other people see us. And we see ourselves as we see ourselves. That is, most of us have certain ideals and standards and hopes and aspirations. I would like to be like this. I'd like to be a real gentleman. I'd like to be a strong, silent type. I'd like to be something else. I'd like to be so that I don't make mistakes. But I find over here I'm something very different. We have our hopes and our aspirations. And we see ourselves as we would like to be. And we see ourselves as we actually are. And the difference between the two can sometimes make us care and make us unhappy. Now, this ability to care about what I think about myself, or to care about what I think other people are thinking of me, that's a function we cannot escape doing. And it's the function that makes it possible for us to have a sense of responsibility, of duty, of loyalty, of decency, self-respect. All the things that make us civilized human beings are only possible because we can't escape caring about what we think other people are thinking of us or what we think about ourselves. Now, this ability to care is a very valuable and very worthwhile thing. But sometimes we care too much. Sometimes we may think other people are thinking unkind things of us when they're actually not. Caring too much can make us over self-conscious, make us oversensitive, overcritical of ourselves, and can make us quite unhappy. Now, I said alcohol is an anesthetic. What's that got to do, and what's this ability to care got to do with our drinking problem? Let's take an illustration. Supposing that I go downtown with a social drinker tonight, as I used to do quite frequently during my drinking days, and we get on to have a couple of drinks before we go home. I buy a round of drinks, and I wait for him, and take about 5 minutes to drink it, and he buys a round of drinks, I buy a round of drinks. Look, what's happening when we drink this alcohol, it goes into our stomach. It can't make us drunk while it's in our stomach. It has to pass from the stomach into the bloodstream. Then it starts to circulate with the blood, and it begins to detonate higher levels, working downward. Say we have three drinks, then we have four drinks. Now, if we take about 5 minutes to each drink, we will have been there about 20 minutes. By now, I'll begin to notice about him, this fellow that was pretty self-conscious and reserved and standoffish, a stiff shirt, kind of fuddy-duddy in his ways and over-meticulous. He's beginning to unbend. Have another drink. He says, no thanks, I don't want any more. I say, come on, 5 minutes won't hurt you. He says, no, I promised my wife I'd be home at 6 o'clock, and the jerk walks off and goes home. Now, I promised my wife I'd be home at 6 o'clock, but I move on down the bar to strike up an acquaintance with somebody else. Though I was determined, before I came into this place, I'm just going to have two or three drinks. I find that I know I'm spending money I shouldn't, but I don't care because I can't care, because the part of my brain that makes caring possible is temporarily deadened. The alcohol has gotten into my blood, it's started to deaden these higher layers of my brain. I know perfectly well what I'm doing. I know I promised my wife I'd be home at 6 o'clock, and I know I'm lying when I call her up and tell her. I know what I'm doing, but I don't care because I can't care, because the part of my brain that makes caring possible is temporarily deadened. I go on to get drunk. But now you should say to me, if alcohol is an anesthetic for me and deadens the higher layers of my brain, why didn't it do the same thing to this other fellow, this social drinker? It's an anesthetic for him too, isn't it? Why didn't he lose his ability to care? You see, thus far I've been talking about the effect of alcohol on the human being. There are enough books written on that subject to fill this room. And I assure you, you will not find the answers to these questions in those books. Those books about how does alcohol affect the human body will not give you the answers to the difference between the social drinker and the problem drinker. Where then lies the difference? Where is the answer? It wasn't until I got the bright idea to turn the question around the other way. Look, alcohol is always the same. It should produce the same results. But we also know that no two human bodies are exactly the same. Maybe it isn't what the alcohol does to my body. Maybe it's the way my body handles the alcohol. Now, I'm going to illustrate four body processes: absorption, distribution, combustion, and body chemistry, to illustrate how different people's bodies handle alcohol in different ways. And those differences can determine whether or not you can maintain a sensible control of yourself when you drink. What is the first thing? I drink that alcohol, it goes into my stomach. Now, it has to pass from stomach to bloodstream before it can begin to have any effect upon me at all. That process of passing from stomach to bloodstream is called absorption, and it's been studied in clinics and laboratories, and the most important thing we find out is this. There is a great difference in the rate and the amount of absorption of alcohol between different people, and that difference is so great that with some people, inside of 10 minutes, 90% of the alcohol they drink will have passed into their bloodstream, will be going to their brain to deaden the higher layers. With other people, it may take 30, 45, 50, or 60 minutes for the same fraction of the alcohol they drink to get from stomach to bloodstream. That's a scientific fact, but let's think it through. Remember, we're dealing with an anesthetic. It's going to produce a deadening effect on the brain. Supposing in 20 minutes of drinking, if I've got a rapid rate of absorption, what has been happening? More alcohol's been getting into my bloodstream. More deadening has been taking effect on the higher layers of my brain. If this other fellow has a slow rate of absorption, practically all of the four drinks that he consumed are still in his stomach. He's got a filled-up, bloated feeling in his stomach. And when he says, I don't want any more, he's stating the simple truth. My stomach is empty and there's more room for more liquor to be poured into me. He has not had as much deadening in the higher layers of his brain. He may have enough deadening that he'll unbend about some of his excessive self-consciousness and some of his fuddy-duddy ways. But he will not have lost his ability to care about money, about promises, about duties and responsibilities, and about tomorrow and next week's paycheck. I maintain that the person that has a slow rate of absorption as an automatic protection provided by his body, and it hasn't got a thing to do with his morals or his loving his wife more than I love my wife or any of the other excuses and explanations that have ordinarily been offered to it. Let's go on and consider the next body process. What else does the body do with the alcohol once we drink it? After the alcohol gets into the bloodstream, it starts to circulate with the blood. It is carried wherever the blood goes. And a certain amount of the alcohol is deposited, just like a certain amount of the blood is deposited in various body tissues. This again has been studied, and we find again another important fact, the very same important fact, I should say, that there is a great difference with different individuals in the rate, the amount, and the extent of the distribution of alcohol with different people. And that difference is so great that with some people, as much as 30, 40, or 50% of the alcohol they drink will be deposited out here in the heavy fleshy parts of the body, and it never will get to their brains to produce deadening. But now, there is a thing called favorable distribution. It is even, regular distribution into all parts of the body and about the same amount in all the different parts. If a person has good distribution through the heavy fleshy parts of the body, they also have good distribution through the central nervous system or the brain. Such a person, as the alcohol that he drinks, as it gets to the brain, it will distribute about evenly through all three divisions of the brain. As that person takes a second and a third and a fourth drinks, he'll begin to get a little deadening of the higher layers, yes, enough that he won't feel so self-conscious and ill at ease. But at about the same time, he'll get some deadening of the middle division of the brain. Those divisions and layers of the brain that control your muscle tensions and your muscle coordinations, this fellow will begin to feel relaxed. Those muscles up and down the back, those muscles in the arm, the muscle tensions all over his body will start to go away. He'll feel like he wants to melt into a chair and just relax and take it easy. Now look, these muscle tensions are very important. They are the source of the stimuli that make us feel like a racehorse, make us feel like we want to go places and do things in a big way. It's because of your muscle tensions. And if you relax those muscle tensions, you not only lack the stimuli to give you the bright ideas to go places and do things in a big way, write checks, get into arguments, go dancing, drive your car fast, and a number of other things, you not only can't get those ideas, you don't have the muscle coordination to carry them out. But as this individual is getting even distribution down to the lower divisions of the brain, those are the layers, remember, that control your breathing and your heartbeat. Your breathing and heartbeat are the power plant of your body. This is the motor is the power plant of a car. When you slow down your breathing and heartbeat, you haven't got the power and energy to carry out a bright idea, even if you got a bright idea. This fellow who has even distribution, in the first place, he's going to have more alcohol deposited out here, less will get to the brain at all. And above that that does get to the brain, it'll be distributed evenly through all parts of the brain. He'll get a relaxed, reclining feeling. He'll get a slowing down of breathing and heartbeat. If he drinks too much, he'll go to sleep. He'll pass out. He'll not black out. And long before he passes out, he'll still have enough ability to care that he'll see that it happens in his own kitchen and not on a bar stool. Now, contrast him with a fellow that has poor distribution. In the first place, there will not be so much alcohol deposited out in the heavy fleshy parts, leaving more to get to the brain. When it does get to the brain, it will not distribute. It remains concentrated in the higher levels. He'll lose his ability to care about his responsibilities, his promises, his duty, his money, and the things that really should be important to him. He will not be able to care about them. He'll get a concentrated deadening. If he does very much drinking, he'll black out. He won't pass out. And even when he's blacked out, he'll still have enough muscle coordination to go get into fights, write bogus checks, and get himself into all kinds of trouble and get his life unmanageable. I maintain that the fellow that has favorable, even distribution has an automatic protection provided by his body that makes it far more likely that he'll keep out of trouble when he does any drinking, and he's not so likely to get his life unmanageable. The fellow who has poor distribution, of course, has just the opposite. Now, I'm afraid I might forget this, so let me hasten to point this out. No one of these things I'm talking about is the cause of alcoholism. Many a good research worker has been misled because he finds there's a difference in absorption rate. Maybe the rate of absorption is the cause of alcoholism. It is no such a thing. It is a contributing factor. I'm only mentioning four body processes. Remember, there are dozens of other body processes that make the difference whether you have protections when you drink or you lack protections when you drink and you're going to get into trouble. There are people who have a rapid rate of absorption that are social drinkers. And there are many alcoholics that have a slow rate of absorption. It's the various combinations of body protections that they enjoy that make it possible for some people to be social drinkers, while others of us cannot be because we do not possess those protections. Let me move on to the third body process, combustion. Another thing the body does when the alcohol gets into the bloodstream, the body releases certain chemicals that attack the alcohol, break it down, burn it up, and convert it into energy. Also, they cause the body to throw up and get rid of certain of the alcohol. They eliminate some of it. This is called combustion. It's a part of the general process called metabolism. But if we were to take 100,000 or 1,000,000 people, enough to make a reliable statistical sample, and measure the rate at which their bodies burn up and eliminate the excess alcohol in their bloodstream, and make a scale. Let 0 be the slowest rate of combustion a person could have and still live when he drinks. Let 100 be the highest rate a person could have and still live when he drinks alcohol. We would find that the great majority of these people would have higher rates of combustion, up around 75, 85, 95, or 100. A small minority of us around would have combustion rates of 25, 15, 5, or 0. Now, why do I say the majority would have rapid rates of combustion? Because it parallels the estimates made by the best experts that we've got. You've all heard it said that it's estimated there are between 65 and 70 million social drinkers in America. Social drinkers are people who can take a drink of alcohol any darn time they want to. They drink as much as they want to. They just don't want to drink too much. I am convinced that no person could possibly, it's humanly impossible to be a social drinker if you don't possess these body protections. Maybe not the specific ones I'm talking about, but they must possess some body functions that protect them when they drink, or they couldn't possibly be social drinkers. The 4 to 6 million of us who are alcoholics lack those protections in some form or in some combination. Okay, rate of combustion. What does that mean in terms of your ability to keep your life manageable and to be powerful over alcohol, or the opposite? Your rate of combustion is your rate of recuperation from whatever alcohol you might drink. Let's take another illustration to illustrate this point. Supposing two persons, one with a high rate of combustion, one with a low rate of combustion, go out to do some drinking tonight. Let's assume that they go out and do some real good two-fisted drinking, and they both get good and drunk. They come home. The one fellow, all during the night, his body will be burning up and eliminating the excess alcohol from his bloodstream. Comes the morning, he may wake up. He may have a hangover. He may have the whips and jingles. But enough of the excess alcohol has been burned out of his bloodstream so that those higher layers of the brain are now free to function normally. He wakes up, he not only knows he should get to work and sober up, but he is able to care. He's able to think about next payday, about the boss, about the job and all the responsibilities, about the kids and the wife and the family. It's because he's able to care because the higher layers of his brain have been freed because his body burned up the excess alcohol in his bloodstream. He takes a drink of tomato juice, a cold shower, shakes his head and gets off to work. He sobers up, he recuperates rapidly. The other person, I wake up the next morning, yes, I'm sick too, like he was sick. And I'm conscious, I know I should get to work, but the higher layers of my brain may be even more deeply deadened than they were the night before. I know I should get to work, but I don't care because I can't care because the part of my brain that makes caring possible is temporarily deadened. Now let me go a little further and illustrate. I could give you some dramatic examples of persons with a high rate of combustion who can recuperate within 30 or 20 minutes from 3 or 4 good stiff Boilermakers. I've seen persons who have consumed a pint of whiskey inside of 10 or 15 minutes, and inside of another 15 or 20 minutes, they've been practically cold sober because their bodies burned up and eliminated the excess alcohol. There are some people whose bodies have such a high rate of combustion that they have a kind of a running protection. They are recuperating from their drinks almost as fast as they are taking their drinks. They are able to enjoy a certain amount of carefree feeling, a certain amount of mellow glow, but their body does not allow them to lose control of themselves long enough to get their lives unmanageable. I maintain that a person with a favorable rate of combustion has an automatic protection provided by his body, and it's not because of he's a superior breed of cat or has higher moral qualities. The person who has a low rate of combustion has the opposite. Okay, one more thing, body chemistry. Why do we drink? We drink for the feelings, for the effect isn't it? Now, the very sensations that you experience can be changed or determined by your body chemicals. There are certain body chemicals, most dramatic among them is adrenaline secreted by the adrenal glands, but there are certain body chemicals that have the direct opposite effect of the alcohol. Whereas alcohol deadens the higher layers of the brain, adrenaline is a powerful stimulant. It stimulates, wakes up these higher layers of the brain. And some of these body chemicals can cause us to experience different sensations. Now, we all have glands and we all have body chemicals, but our bodies may respond differently. There are some people, for instance, whose bodies react in such a way that the mere presence of alcohol in the bloodstream causes the adrenal glands to secrete adrenaline. And the adrenaline gets in the bloodstream, stimulates parts of the brain. Such people, if they were to drink 1 or 2 ounces of alcohol, that would trigger their adrenal glands. They'd get a stimulating of the higher layers of the brain. They would actually feel more apprehensive, more on guard, more cautious and wary than before they actually took the drink. This might be a part of what leads some people to think alcohol is a stimulant. Those people are stimulated, but by their own adrenaline, not by the alcohol they drank. But you see, this causes them to experience a different sensation. 1 or 2 drinks and they feel on guard and wary. That's not the same kind of an experience that most of us experience. There are some people who, because of their body chemicals and the way their glands react, they'll get a sensation as if they were losing control of their mind or as if they were going to fall off a cliff backwards when they do very much drinking. To such people, the drinking of alcohol is so unpleasant that they don't enjoy it. And unfortunately, some of those people wrap about them a cloak of I am holier than thou and assume it's because they are superior people that they get these different kind of sensations. It is not their superior morals, it's their difference in body chemistry. Now, there are some people whose glands will come to their rescue when they pull a social faux pas, so they mispronounce a word, or they get too friendly with the wrong wife, or they start to stagger or something. Their glands will come to the rescue, stimulate, prod, wake up their higher layers of their brain. Those people have a kind of a running fire department that puts out the sparks before any flames ever break out. Their body chemistry keeps them from becoming powerless over alcohol and from getting their lives unmanageable. Now let me remind you again. I've mentioned body chemistry, combustion, distribution, and absorption. There are dozens of other body processes. Nobody lacks these protections 100%. Nobody possesses them 100%. It is the presence of these protections and other body process protections, the presence in various degrees and various combinations, that make it possible for some people to maintain a sensible control of themselves when they drink. Oftentimes we say, what is an alcoholic? And we try to measure by, well, how much liquor did you consume? Did you lie about your drinks? Did you hide bottles and so forth? Those are only symptoms. They're symptoms of our unmanageable life. They're not symptoms of our alcoholism. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person whose body processes do not give him the protections that enable him to maintain sensible control of himself when he drinks alcoholic beverages. A social drinker is a person who enjoys such degrees and combinations of body protections that they are able to maintain a sensible control of themselves even when they drink alcoholic beverages. Now look, this leads us to certain very important conclusions. Number one, alcoholism is a real disease. It's not just figuratively speaking. We're not just talking in metaphors when we say alcoholism is a disease. Look, there are many kinds of diseases. When germs invade your body like a cold or like typhoid fever or diphtheria, those are called infectious diseases. There are some diseases like beriberi, scurvy, the rickets, malnutrition, that are called deficiency diseases. There are some diseases like most heart diseases, like arthritis, like diabetes, diseases that can kill you, that are called functional diseases. I am convinced alcoholism is a functional disease. That minority of us, the 4 to 6 million alcoholics, lack the body protections that make it possible for the great majority of people to be social drinkers without getting their lives unmanageable. This leads us to certain other conclusions. Look, I heard it said in a newspaper in my hometown, when Alcoholics Anonymous came there and got started, is that these Alcoholics Anonymous claim it is a disease. If so, quote, it is a self-inflicted disease. There are many of us, when we make our moral inventory, that go about flagellating and condemning ourselves, assuming that we made alcoholics out of ourselves. I'm quite convinced that is false. The excessive drinking was the effect, not the cause. The body process is changed first, and then the excessive drinking was the consequence. The excessive drinking did not cause your body processes to change. Okay, it leads us to some other things. This probably is more important than any. One of the moralists said, if you had willpower, you could drink as I do. It's because you lack character. It's because you have no sense of values. It's because you have no sense of responsibility. If he were telling the truth, then all we would have to do would be to develop willpower and we could become social drinkers. Develop a sense of moral values, develop a sense of propriety, and those things can be developed. I'm afraid many of us have made that terrible and that tragic mistake because we didn't understand that we're not kidding. We're not just bantying words around when we say this is a physical disease. It is a physical disease, this alcoholism. So you see, many a person has stayed sober 5 years, 10 years. I've known them to have stayed sober 20 years and then go back to drinking. Why did they go back to drinking? Because they were defenseless. They believed the moralist who said, willpower, character, morals, sense of value, good judgment, and they knew damn well they had those qualities. Which of us couldn't point to our own lives? I was the only one out of a family of 9 kids that worked my way through college. This very older brother who pointed the finger of scorn at me didn't have guts enough to work his way through college. He quit after the first 2 years. I could prove I had willpower, guts, backbone, and all the rest of it. Just point to certain periods of your life and you know you got those. So you see, the terrible error and the terrible fallacy of the moralist is that if he were telling the truth, we'd be perfectly logical when we went back to try a little more drinking to see if we had developed enough willpower, enough character, etc. But you see, this way, it is inescapable. You cannot change your body processes by willpower, character, moral values, or anything else. There's no way known to man whereby your body processes can be changed to give you the protection that the social drinker enjoys. I don't care how smart you get, you're not going to be able to outsmart your body. You might even be able once in a while to outsmart your wife, but you can't outsmart your body. Now, we could say this has been talking about the disease of alcoholism, but the allergy part. Some books define an allergy as an abnormal reaction. Look, if the great majority of people, 65 to 70 million people or social drinkers, enjoy body protections that make social drinking possible. They are the normal. We, the 4 to 6 million, are the abnormal. We lack those body protections. It is an abnormal reaction we get to alcohol. But now, what about the other part of this question, the obsession of the mind? Why did we go back? Most of us, before we ever came into AA, long before we came into AA, we knew darn well we couldn't handle our liquor. We knew where we should have known from the trouble we were getting into before we came to AA that we ought to leave this stuff alone. But why did we go back time and time again and take a few drinks? How many thousands of times did I resolve and determine, now I'm just going to take one or two drinks, and I'd get started and out of hell with the whole thing and go on to get drunk? Why did we come back like a moth flying into a candle flame time and time again to go on another binge, to take another drink? Why? This, I think, is the obsession of the mind. Now, I'd like to clarify this point. I've read some pamphlets in AA that talk about us having a compulsion. I don't believe we have a compulsion. I think it would do well if we understood what an obsession is. What is an obsession of the mind? An obsession of the mind is an idea that seems to come into your head, and it seems to have power of its own. Let me illustrate. I could give any one of you people the darnest obsession to unscrew a bench vise that you ever heard of. You know what a bench vise is? It's a tool and a shot that sits on the bench and has two big jaws that come together when you turn a handle here and come together with terrific force and just crush things. I could give you an obsession to unscrew a bench vise by just putting your hand in there and screw the darn thing up until you started to scream with pain. Now, I could try to get your mind off of that thing. Tell you to look at the funny books, or look at the beautiful gal coming down the street, or look at this, that, or the other. You say, to hell with the funny books, to hell with the beautiful gal, unscrew the bench vise. You got an unscrew the bench vise obsession. You can't seem to get your mind off it. Well, now, of course, it's so simple, it seems obvious. The reason you can't think of anything but unscrewing that bench vise is because it hurts the damn bad. No, that isn't the only reason. I couldn't give a baby an obsession to unscrew the bench vise. I couldn't give a dog or an animal an obsession to unscrew that bench vise. There's something else required. It is the pain plus knowledge of what will give relief. You know that unscrewing that bench vise will give you relief from the pain. That's why you can't think of anything but unscrewing the bench vise. Now, what is our great obsession, we the problem drinkers? Our great obsession is the idea, I'd like a drink. And we try to drive it out of our... No, I'm an alcoholic and I can't handle my liquor. I won't have a drink. The day goes on, we have a rough time. The wife gives us an argument or work goes bad. Damn, a drink, it sure tastes good. Or we're tired. No, I won't think about that drink. We drive it out of our mind and the damn idea keeps coming back. That is an obsession. An idea that just seems to keep coming back and you can't seem to get rid of it. Now, where does this obsession come from? Where does it get its power, and why does it keep coming back? Why do we keep getting this bright idea that I'd like to have a drink? What is the thing causing us the pain? We hear a lot about stinking thinking in AA. I'd like to give you a new term, squealing feelings. Every one of us has feelings of failure, feelings of defeat, feelings of inferiority, feelings of insecurity, feelings of not being wanted. Who knows better than us, the sick alcoholic, those feelings of shame and guilt and remorse? 1,000 squealing feelings boiling and stewing inside of us. Now, we didn't know how come or why, and we didn't give a damn. But we certainly knew that no matter how we feel, one or two drinks and we feel better. Even when we felt good, I longed to feel more carefree, want to feel free from all restraint. We knew from experience, one or two drinks and we did feel free from all restraint. When we wanted to feel even more carefree than carefree, one or two drinks, no matter what our trouble was, or whether we had any trouble or not, we knew that one or two drinks and we felt better. We didn't know that it was by deadening that a part of our brain that enabled us to care about things that we should care about. Well, now look. On living with our feelings of shame and guilt and painful excessive self-consciousness and feelings of not being wanted and not being loved. You've got to have relief from that. Just like an automobile trying to drive down the street with the emergency brake on, it may growl along in low gear and you think the thing's going to stop. It's got to have relief from those dragging brakes. But it is not entitled to the relief by disconnecting the brakes from the steering system, too. And that's exactly what we did when we deadened those higher layers of our brain. We disconnected our brakes from our steering system. Now, you've got to have relief, but how can you get it? Now we can come to the AA program. I'm sure that for at least 3 years, before I ever came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going around, 5 years at least. I was going around trying to behave like the social drinker. I'd steal drinks, I'd hide drinks, and then try to act as if the drinks weren't having an effect on me. I was as phony as a $3 bill with my pretenses and my trying to keep up with the social drinker and try to behave like the social drinker, being sloppy drunk and trying to conceal the fact that I was sloppy drunk. Step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. I felt like a thief in the night until I took step one. Oh, what a relief that was that I didn't have to pretend to be a social drinker anymore. Go and look at other of the steps. Maybe I better illustrate this a little further. Look, we have only 4 basic emotions. There's anger, fear, grief, and love. Any kind of a feeling you can feel inside of you, feeling defeated, is a combination of fear and grief and sometimes anger and frustration, resentment or anger. Any kind of a feeling that we experience that's painful or unpleasant inside of us is a combination of some of these basic, these four basic emotions. Now look, you'd be a pretty sick person if you couldn't get mad or angry at certain things. Things happen to us that any healthy person should get angry about. He should get about that angry. But we get that angry. We over-respond. Certain things happen to all of us that should cause us to experience fear or anxiety or worry, all of which are fear. We should experience that much, but we experience that much. And so with grief, and so with love. Now, why is it that we over-respond? We over-respond because we got 1,000 skeletons in our closet inside of us. 1,000 things. Now look, here's another thing that bothers me. A lot of us go into the reading of these books on psychiatry and psychology trying to find what kind of an unhappy childhood you might have had that caused you to become an alcoholic. I don't think the psychological background or childhood caused any of us to become an alcoholic. It may have caused us to feel like hell, and it may have caused us to over-respond. But many a person, and you don't have to look far to find plenty of people in AA who had ideal and model childhoods, and they can't point back to any gruesome and terrible childhood, yet they're just as alcoholic as any of us, the first time or the first few times, that their body fails to give them the protection. So they turned out getting drunk when they didn't intend to get drunk, and lying about their drinks when they didn't intend to lie about their drinks, and doing things that were foreign to their nature. We can all accumulate enough squealing feelings inside of us, enough incidents that we've completely forgotten about. But these incidents inside of us are just like steam in a steam boiler. They cause us to over-respond. They cause the little thing that would cause anybody to experience a little worry to cause me to experience 10 times as much worry. The little thing that anybody would be a little bit annoyed about, I'm raging, I am mad about the thing. We over-respond because inside of us are a lot of past painful experiences that we haven't known what to do about. So, we take step 4. We make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That begins to pin down some of the squirrel cage in the garbage train that keeps going round and round in our head, and we begin to get someplace. Then we admit to ourselves and to God and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Going around cuddling to ourselves, these skeletons, these things we were ashamed of, these things that we didn't dare speak of to a social drinker who couldn't understand our experiences and how we could so completely lose our self-respect and so forth. As we talk about them to other AAs, as we talk about them to a minister or somebody that we can trust like we can trust God, as we admit them, we dig them up. The very causes of these squealing feelings, the causes of this excess responding, this over-responding. We make a list of the people that we have harmed and try to make amends to them all. Even if we can't make amends to them, just the very process of listing down some of the people we have hurt gives us a feeling of accomplishment, moves us in a changed attitude towards rectifying the things that were causing us to feel so many of these squealing feelings. Do you see how we're getting at the very heart of the pain that causes us to get the bright idea, I'd like a drink? As we go on to steps 9 and actually do make amends to these people and continue to take a moral inventory and when wrong, promptly admit it. Instead of trying to cover up a lie and defend a point where I was wrong in the first place, I start admitting I'm wrong and I don't have to be so defensive. Do you see how every step of the AA program gets right at the heart of the things that cause me to feel these moods and these states of mind and this excessive self-consciousness? And then I come into an AA meeting. I don't know very many of you people. One or two of you had seen me before. But I come in a stranger. I who have suffered through years of feeling unwanted and unnecessary and unworthwhile. I feel welcome. I feel loved. Each of us, as we come to AA meetings, the newcomer who staggers in that door, sick or well, he's made to feel welcome. This, as we give of our love, as we deliberately exert ourselves to extend kindness to somebody else, it not only makes better people of us, better people not because of some fancy morals in the sky, but better people because it's helping us convert some of these skeletons in our closets into a healthy feeling of love and kindness and laughter and goodwill towards our fellow man. But that other guy coming in, who's been suffering from being booted out, being rejected, being unwanted, he gets a healing ointment better than any doctor could prescribe for him. Do you see how each step, every action and every function of the AA program as a means of getting at that pain inside of us. I get sick and tired of these psychiatrists that say we were trying to escape reality. We weren't trying to escape the external reality. Some of the painful realities inside of us, yes, we were trying to get relief from it. Now maybe I can come back and answer that question. Why did we go back, like a moth flying into a candle flame, again and again, to take that first drink even when we knew damn well we couldn't handle our liquor? Nothing caused us to do it. You're doomed to failure if you're looking for the cause. What caused me to take that first drink? Nothing caused me to do it. Things may cause me to feel pretty lousy and pretty miserable, but I took that drink for the purpose of getting relief from painful and unpleasant feelings, moods, states of mind inside of myself, and I got relief. Now I've found through AA that there is a better way to get relief. There's a way to attack these problems inside of me and cut down this over-responding, cut down this resenting. Not by denying that I resent, but by talking about it openly and honestly in AA meetings. I learned how to convert these squealing feelings that were killing me, that were making life unbearable to me. I learned how to convert them into feelings of kindness or feelings of laughter or healthy anger that I can handle or healthy worry or healthy fear that I am able to handle. I learned how to handle and channel those very emotions, those very feelings that were causing me to feel so bad that I got that obsessive idea, I want a drink. Now, especially if we find some concept of a power greater than ourselves that we can do business with. I was born and reared in a community that had one prevailing religion that thought God was a man with body parts and passions. He was a moral tyrant in the sky. I had a childish notion that God rewarded the good and punished the wicked. I had been scolded, I had been naughty, I had been mean, I had been such a little scamp, and my parents believed in spare the rod and spoil the child, and they didn't want any spoiled children, so they used up quite a few rods. But I felt God up there in the sky sat with a cosmic ledger book writing down all the bad things I had done and a cosmic baseball bat ready to knock my can off if he ever caught me. Well, my attitude towards him was, look, old man, you mind your business and I'll mind mine. One day you'll get me, but I'm going to have a lot of fun until you do. Even after I grew up, got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't realize that my idea of God was one thing and God was another thing. I didn't realize that though my body had grown, my conception, my idea of God had not grown. It had not changed. And I thought my idea of God and God were one and the same thing. It took another crisis, though I never went back to drinking, to force me into a different community, a different location, where I had to seek a new and a different idea of God. If you are so fortunate that you can go back to the religion of your childhood, God bless you, do that. That's the healthy thing to do. But if you find yourself still knocking around, and still unsatisfied and still squirming with a bunch of questions about this power greater than yourself that don't make sense, and this old crap about look at the electric light switch, no man understands electricity, and yet boom, it's a power greater than ourselves. That doesn't make sense to me. Certainly it may be true that nobody knows precisely what electricity is, but we sure as heck know how to make it work. We can take it and run it through one kind of a coil and it'll heat our houses for us. Take it and run it through something else and it'll produce a refrigerator. Take it and run it through something else, we build an electric motor. We may not know what it is, but we certainly know how to make it work. Now, we may not know what God is, but we have to know how to make ourselves work with him or it or whatever it is. We may find that it's not God, but our idea of God that needs changing. We may find that if we actually tackle steps 2, 3, 5, 11, I think many of us have found, like the Christian scientist gal that came into the drugstore and said, I'm constipated, can you tell me what I could do? And the pharmacist said, here's some castor oil, take that. And she said, I don't believe in internal medicine. He said, lady, you don't have to believe in it, just take it. We may not believe in prayer, but as we talk to our own soul, our own mind, something seems to happen. And we do find a power greater than ourselves. Now, is my watch correct? Quarter past? I took too long on the first two parts of my talk. Those of you who have been able to go back to the religion of your childhood, those of you who have found a religion, I beg of you, don't let this offend you. But I found it necessary to seek in a different way for a different conception of God. And I found it, there's something living about me. I don't know what life is either. But I do know that as I get depressed, as I get melancholy, blue and gloomy, as I get down into a state of apathy, I'm less alive. Have you ever seen any of these patients in a mental hospital that are in a state of melancholy? Never show any signs of life except when they get a bright idea as to how they might successfully commit suicide. The person who is down in a state of apathy is less alive. Being alive is a matter of degrees. If you can bring your feelings from apathy even to fear, you're more alive. If you can bring them from fear to anger, you're a little more alive. If you can bring them from anger to grief, you're still more alive. If you can bring them up to laughter, and all emotions are basically the same thing, they're life energy, life stuff within us. And it's a combination of our feelings and our emotions combined with our mind and our total mind. Look, if we were to take our conscious mind, your memory, your brains, the part that you think of when you think of your mind, your ability to think, to reason, to remember, and figure, and all the things that you think you could do with your conscious mind, draw a circle to represent it, you'd have a circle about that size. But if you were to take your total mind, your whole unconscious and subconscious mind, you'd have to draw a circle bigger than this building to represent it. There are powers within your own mind, and look, mind and soul mean one and the same thing. There are powers within your soul, below the level of your direct and immediate control. Powers of intuition. All of you gals believe in intuition. I used to deny it, and so I didn't have any. When I went through some psychotherapy for about 2 or 3 or 4 years, I found out that it is a real part of the human mind, and it's possible to develop it. Clairvoyance and mental telepathy, the ability to know things that are happening removed from you in time and place, have been proved. Your mind, if we get your conscious mind out of the way, we can say to your unconscious mind, you're stiff, you can't bend. Your unconscious mind will make your muscles so stiff they can put your head on one chair, your feet on another chair, and a 200-pound man can sit in the middle of you. Some of you may say, I've got a very poor memory. If we get your conscious mind out of the way and tell your unconscious mind to give back this talk that Hansen's giving, you'd give it back word for word, just like a tape recorder. Where I mispronounce words, you'd mispronounce words. Where my voice goes up, your voice would go up. You've got a perfect recording of this whole talk in your own unconscious mind. There are powers to heal the body. There are powers to change their body. There are powers to obtain from other minds and other souls and from sources far beyond ourselves. This has been proved scientifically. I don't know what this power greater than myself is, but I do know that when I pray, nobody comes and sits on the windowsill and says, yes, and takes a few notes and flies off up to cloud 16. But whenever I pray, it's spoken into my own soul. Whatever my contact or communication with a higher power, it's through my own soul. I found that it is possible for me to get a few ideas by the tail feathers. Certainly I don't understand it all, but it makes a little more sense to me than mouthing words to some moral tyrant in the sky who's already got me down with such a black record that he's got nothing but punishment for me. It makes it possible for me to conceive of a power that I can work with, a power that can be forgiving, a power that can be kind, that can be called on, a power that's with me at all times and that I can't break away from. Well, now, Bob, I've given you some ideas, but let me repeat what I said at the beginning. Actually, this is chiefly what happened to me. I think you've gotten an idea about what I was like before AA and during my drinking days. You might say what I was like could be illustrated by two stories. One is the story of the little boy who went fishing. In his excitement, he fell off into the river. They dragged him out and got him up on shore, and some kind soul said, "Young man, could you tell us how you came to fall in?" The kid looks at him and says, "Mister, I didn't come to fall in. I came to go fishing." Now, my drinking, in one sense, was that way. And people would ask me, "Why do you get so drunk? You should be ashamed of yourself. Why do you do the things you do?" I did not intend to do those things. I only intended to have one or two drinks and behave myself like a gentleman, but I didn't know I was dealing with an anesthetic, and I didn't know about these higher layers of the brain. Now, the part of my drinking was could be illustrated by another story. Here again, before I even tell this story, I'd like to make this point. I think if we make the mistake, and it's easy to make, look at step five, says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five says we admitted to ourselves to God and another human being. Six says we're entirely ready to let God remove our defects of character. Seven says we humbly ask Him. Now, a lot of us have a tendency to go back into the sanctimonious, holy, holy, goody-goody feeling that I've got to be so perfect, I've got to be so good in order to maintain my sobriety. Now, I have nothing against goodness. I have nothing against morals. They're wonderful and they're grand in their own right. But your sobriety will be on pretty slippery and thin ice if you think that by being sanctimonious and goody-goody, you're guaranteeing your sobriety if you don't have the understanding of the rest of the program. So in a sense, another aspect of my drinking could be illustrated by the story of the drunk who used to come home drunk every night. His wife would yell and scream at him and been throwing dishes at him for about 13, 14 years. So one of her girlfriends got her aside and said, "Look, Peggy, you've been yelling and screaming at that guy for about 13 years and it's never gotten you any place. Why don't you change and try loving kindness?" So the next night the old man comes home, she meets him at the door and says, "Come in, dear, I've been waiting for you. Here are your house slippers and your favorite chair. Here's the newspaper. Would you like something from the refrigerator?" She fusses and flutters over him all night long. Come about midnight, she says, "Dear, would you like to go to bed with me now? It's getting pretty late." He says, "I might as well. I'll get hell when I get home anyway." It was staying sober for moralistic reasons, for holy, holy reasons. And if you've done one thing wrong, you might as well go whole hog because you'll get hell when you get home anyway. Now, I'm sorry I've talked so long, but just one more thing. I'm going to wind up. As Ken told you, I'm totally blind. I've been that way for about 30 years. I got shot up with dynamite gas when I was a kid. Now, for the past 15, 20 years, I've been mostly engaged in vocational rehabilitation, taking people who have a physical handicap, a physical disability, retraining them, helping them so they can become self-supporting again. Now, I've seen practically every kind and combination of physical affliction. I've seen people who were blind and deaf at the same time, who were blind and deaf and had a leg amputated. I've seen almost every kind and combination of physical affliction. I think I know what I'm talking about when I say to be an alcoholic and not know it, or to be an alcoholic and be unable or unwilling to do anything about it, is the worst affliction that can befall a human being. Because I don't care how charming your personality, I don't care how marvelous your intellect, I don't care how wonderful your talents, if you lack these body protections and go on drinking, it's purely a matter of time till you become a disgusting, contemptible menace to society, and the world will hate you, and it has a right to hate you. On the other hand, there is no condition from which recovery can be so complete. I take the person who went blind, I retrain him, and he supports his family and gets a lot of happiness out of life, but he remains blind. I take the person who is an amputee, he lost his legs, I retrain him, he earns his living, gets a lot of happiness out of life, but he remains an amputee. Now, there's nothing about this disease, alcoholism, that'll shorten your life or make it impossible for you to be happy. There's no condition from which recovery can be so complete. If in the course of your AA, you not only get sober, but you get to the bottom of the causes of these squealing feelings, you become a more pleasant, a more lovable, a more kind, a finer person all the way around, a person that can live with himself, and a person who is, if you find a power greater than yourself with which you can do business, there's no reason why you can't be 1,000% better person through the AA program than you ever were before you started to drink. And I'm not kidding when I say if I could get back eyesight tonight, it'd be wonderful and I'd be most grateful. But it would not be as great a blessing as when I got back my sanity and sobriety and self-respect and all the other wonderful things that go with it through AA and the help of God. Thank you.